I'm Commander Shepard, and this is my favorite lorecast on the Citadel.
Welcome to the Mass Effect Lorecast, the podcast where we explore the vast universe of lore behind the Mass Effect games. We'll talk about all the details you may have missed, ask the hard questions, and more.
Spectres, welcome back to the Mass Effect Lorecast. Look at this, two shows in the same week because we did the other one late and we did this one early. It's crazy. This is your host, Tom, or Robots. I'm here with Sam. And Sam, we have another person as well.
We do. We've been talking about the medicine of Mass Effect for a few weeks now. And so I figured we should probably bring on a special guest from the medical field to help us kind of dissect, is Mass Effect more science or is it more fiction, or and just get some general thoughts about how Mass Effect puts science forward. So, Greg, what's your background in medicine?
This is, oh, by the way, this is Dr. Greg. So Dr. Greg. Welcome. Greg. Can we call you Dr. Greg? I feel like that would be like your TV persona.
I like Dr. Carwash too. That will work too.
Dr. Carwash.
I grew up in the Northwest and my background is in family medicine. So it's kind of this broad specialty. We see a lot of different things, take care of a lot of different people. And it's, I think in the specialty, it's a focus on relationships. So that's one of the things I think I would comment on and we can go into more detail with in the series. I'm not quite full spectrum. I'm not doing inpatient adult medicine, but still take care of newborns and obstetrics, do deliveries and outpatient. And I live in a small town that, so it's kind of rural medicine, limited access in a clinic that takes care of, a full spectrum of folks that, maybe half are, underinsured, or I should say maybe half are on a little more than half are on Medicaid. And we still have a good number of patients that don't have insurance. So resources is a lot of management of what resources are out there is a big part of my day.
So if you were practicing in the Mass Effect universe, would you be seeking out practicing in like a refugee camp on like the Citadel in Mass Effect 3?
Right. Yeah, I think it'd be exactly that down in the lower levels, right? Take care of those who just came on board. That'd be the equivalent maybe. Yeah. And I will tell you, real world versus Mass Effect, there's probably a lot of speculation you're going to hear coming from me as far as, no expert per se, but I'll do my best.
Well, sounds like you've seen a lot of kind of everything in some way or another.
Yeah, there's a lot out there, though, too, I haven't seen, but we do see a good chunk of oddities that come in for sure.
Yeah, Pipe Man here in chat says Morden on Omega vibes, having to do a lot with little resources. So I can see the comparison. And Pipe Man, we're actually going to talk about Morden in a little bit. So you might want to stick around. And we have some questions about specific topics and events in the game. So feel free to speculate as much as you want, Dr. Greg. But at first, as someone working in STEM, what do you like to see in sci-fi? And conversely, what pushes you away from a series?
In science fiction, mostly I think of books and the, I grew up, obviously you can see this background here with Star Wars as my religion replacement in a way. And
I was about to say that you're coming from a completely different galaxy.
Yeah, right. One far, far away.
Yeah.
And I think sci-fi allows you to kind of speculate on what are possible things with what we do know and where we could be going. And, it's the authors and the creators that explore that dive into it in ways that can be really fascinating. How many different ways have we seen authors talk about how we travel these large distances? What does light speed look like? And the Endymion, I forget that whole series name by Simmons. I think it might be that series where the crew gets plastered to the back wall of the ship and gets reconstructed every time they jump to light speed, that there's no way to,
right.
There's one solution. And, it's fun to kind of think about that and play with those ideas. And I like that. And mostly books and video games, it's a little different. I think it's Mass Effect is for me a little bit of an outlier in that way, in that it creates a really rich background of story and going into different nuances that a lot of video games, maybe that's not quite their focus. I didn't know with Mass Effect what I was walking into when I started playing it. So it was kind of a nice treat.
That's kind of a perfect segue, because the next question here I had for you was, how did you get your start with Mass Effect?
Oh, yeah. Well, I was kind of telling Tom earlier, I used to play on PC when I was younger. I grew up in the, you know, Doom era, really. And through college and whatnot, I didn't have time. College and med school, I didn't have a whole lot of time. And the easy way back in was console. And my friends at the time really were, no one was gamers. So I came across probably a little trailer or clip I saw. And when I started Mass Effect, I thought it was just sort of a third person shooter. And as I was, and I explore everything. So I was talking to everyone. I'm like, damn, there's a lot of dialogue here. Okay. Do I need to start paying a little more attention and realizing then what, you know, at first I was taken aback by how much conversation I was doing at the Citadel or, you know, however that started. And then you realize this is what they're building here. And so I just stumbled across Mass Effect. And I think it was when it had, shortly after it came out, Mass Effect 2 was probably already out, because I don't think I had to wait for that. I think I jumped right into Mass Effect 2, but it was at the release. And then I've really only played through it one other time about a year ago when I did my Insanity playthrough last year. So some of the stuff's not super fresh for me too. You might have to remind me.
Well, we've got some clips coming up, so okay. that should be a refresher, but okay. Tom?
Yeah, so we were talking about this in the pre-show when we were setting up about how when you watch media or play games and you have an expertise in a certain area, how that's kind of a double-edged sword, because if they get things right or wrong, sometimes that's ugh, or you end up talking to your spouse about all the things they should have done when they didn't. So on the surface, when it comes to Mass Effect, what did they do right when it comes to medicine, in your opinion, just kind of generally speaking?
Yeah. And you have to probably take it with a grain of salt with the constructs of or limitations of a video game. Right. But in Mass Effect 3, I think when you're on the Citadel, there's a small area, at least, where they show people scattered about and providers helping them. And it looks pretty chaotic. You know, that feeling of we're in an emergency here, we're all hands on deck, that felt real. It would really be bigger and people would be running around a bit more than you see them still standing there after you go and a couple of missions and come back. You're like, you're still standing, you know.
Yeah, but the scale is very limited, but the feeling of the room is what you're talking about.
Yeah, that feel of that. And I think some of the you know, we'll talk, I guess, a little bit about Morden later, but some of those ethical decisions that apply in medicine, they do, I think, very well. And I don't know if I can do spoilers, but what happens with Thane, I think, is...
Yes, spoilers are fine. This is a lore cast. So everybody knows that we're going to spoil something every episode. So yeah, go for it.
Yeah, just dealing with death and loss and knowing that that's coming. I think that the elements there in that arc feels very, you know, resonates, I would say. Technical medical stuff, I don't remember seeing a lot of. I mean, Metagel, you're like, okay, you just spray it on and you're instantly better. Okay, I'll just let that go. We need something like that. You know, I don't get too caught up in that. You know, some games you have to have the right concoction, or you have to take the time and bandage your arm and then clean the bandage for, you know, there's that, but I think that would slow down the gameplay. And so I didn't really get too worked up by that.
You mentioned the ethical decisions as well as the Citadel, you know, when everyone's kind of running around, they're strewn about, it's a bit chaotic. Well, one of the conversations that I recall between two background characters, they're both providers in the Huerta Memorial Hospital in the Citadel, is they're debating whether or not it is ethical to ration care. And what did you think when you first heard that conversation?
Yeah, I don't know what I thought, but I think my response would have been that's very real. That is exactly right. There's nothing fictional about rationing care. It is just the reality we are faced with.
And during a time of war, I mean, it would have to be much, much, much harder, those decisions.
Right. You probably have a lot more restrictions. I mean, we even see here war abroad or crises abroad affect us in little ways, where if you're used to being able to get your medications or have insurance and can get it, there'll be supply shortages. I remember, I think colchicine for gout was suddenly not available because the military was pulling a bunch of it, and I don't know why. So you'll see these things, lidocaine suddenly, what? We don't have lidocaine anymore to numb people up, or we have to, restrict how much we use. So that happens in small ways now that touch us, and, you know, that's not when there's a crisis even in our face. But I think bigger picture resource limitations is ICUs and hospitals and care. And it's, you know, not an equal playing field for who has access, for sure.
Yeah. So we talked about your feeling about things feeling accurate, right? But what about what things they didn't get right? Do you see anything in the games in reference to medicine or practicing it where you just kind of, you get that feeling, you just kind of roll your eyes and you're like, all right.
Mm. Well, if you have specifics, a specific thing you're thinking about, let me know. But I think my general feeling of how mental illness was portrayed, or people becoming, I guess they just go crazy, is not really what psychosis looks like. And that's, everyone does that kind of wrong. It's easy to make them, people suddenly just be weird and crazy, which doesn't really fit what happens for people that have, psychotic illnesses or delusional or hallucinations and other changes that happen. So I'm trying to think, like, it was probably some, I want to say what happened when you rescued Jack. Was Jack, did she come from a prison where people went crazy too? And maybe I'm mixing it up.
She came from a Cerberus prison that was basically experimenting on the kids.
Oh, they were.
And
okay.
there was basically a revolt and everyone started attacking the guards. Yeah.
Okay. So that was not quite the psychosis. I'm thinking of the episode with the plant.
Yes. The Jacob's father's loyalty mission on 2175 Aya, I think was the name of the planet. that was the planet where they, just as a recap for everyone, Jacob's father's ship had crash landed on a planet, and very typical sci-fi kind of setting. The crew is relegated to eat the native fauna. But that is poisonous and leads to neural degradation, whereas the captain, you know, saves the rations for himself, and the neural degradation that the crew has is something you're saying that did not portray psychosis well.
Yeah, that's another. I was actually thinking of another. I think it's from Mass Effect. Well, I think it's also from Mass Effect 2. It was another expansion mission. But that's a good example that you gave, is suddenly, and you can usually, I think you could usually tell pretty quickly because they act so strange in a different way that is not something that we see in human mental illness, that didn't, it just doesn't feel right. It's like, okay, that, and that's fine. It's its own new problem. And it's changing the brain in a way we've never seen. But I think some of the more, and so, yeah. And when I think about mental illness and the way it affects people, those, that part of the story doesn't feel right. It feels, it's just, oh, otherizing them very quickly. And then everything, you know, that does to us, we're like, oh, they're crazy. They did this.
It feels like a bad Star Trek episode.
You know? Yeah. So that mission too, Sam, was one that probably didn't feel like they did that very well, or the way I would wanted it done.
Yeah, I can see that. It was certainly abrupt and a bit villainous, how they portray some psychosis or I guess even indoctrination. But with indoctrination, right, we're encouraged to like suspend disbelief because it's an alien species that's controlling us. But while we're on the topic of real life examples that are also in the game, as we talked about, Tom and I, last episode, Vrolik syndrome is a real condition, and it's one that Joker deals with. So how did you view their depiction of, I believe the medical term is osteogenesis imperfecta, when it came to Joker's life?
Yeah, it's actually not a condition, and I don't know what the prevalence is, but it's not actually something that I've taken care of. But it's sort of a spectrum of disease, and it can manifest in a lot of different ways. But the kind of classic thing you think of is our bone is not just this hard calcium. It has some collagen, other proteins in it that give it its flexibility. And the way that if you see a building going up with concrete, there's rebar in it to do the same type of thing. And so it would be like building bones with just the concrete, or something that's strong but easily shatterable, mm-hmm. rather than having some flexibility. I don't remember Joker getting out of the seat very often. He hobbles around a bit. And I don't know that he'd be hobbling, but it would be easy for him to have a low impact fracture. So I don't think they messed anything up. I know there's certain appearances that you can associate with osteogenesis imperfecta, some head shape stuff. I think someone mentioned the other day, a blue kind of a tint that you can get to the sclera, the white part of the eye that you sometimes see. But I think that was a good syndrome to give him. And I don't remember there being a thing that was, he did that was like, oh no, he couldn't do that. They kept him in the chair. they kept him in the chair most of the time. A lot of cushion.
Yeah, just the one exception I can think of when the Normandy is abducted and the crew's abducted by the collectors, and he was very reluctant to get out of his chair. Mm-hmm. I mean, even when the first Normandy went down, he was reluctant to get out of the chair, although that was more of a moral sticking point with him that he was going to go down with the ship.
Yeah.
Well, Keppel syndrome, I don't believe is real in our world, but it doesn't affect humans, obviously. But is there an analogous condition that does affect people that's similar to Keppel's?
I think so, but remind me. I think Keppel, when I was playing, I remember thinking that Thane was having a breathing or lung, that it was affecting his lung tissue. But is there another component of it too that affects his blood?
I'm a little unsure about the exact, how it works in the body, but I'm fairly sure that you're correct about that, that his lungs are just not transporting the oxygen to the rest of his body. Yeah, because
I pulled it up real quick. The description, at least on one of these articles, is essentially the disease erodes Adrell's ability to consume oxygen and stops blood from producing hemoglobin.
Oh, so that's interesting that Drells have hemoglobin. Interesting. So, yeah, I mean, thinking back to the lung and suffocation, that's very real and very, unfortunately, common. The idea that in some mechanism, his lung oxygen interface is not working is a very common human problem we run into with, it can be our heart not pumping effectively. And so your heart has two different chambers. Blood flows in from the rest of the body to the right atrium and ventricle that gets pumped to the lungs and then goes back to the left ventricle, the main chamber that's pushing it all the way to the rest of our body. And if that's not working, you get a backup in the system. And so the fluid that's still in the lungs trying to get to that left ventricle is backed up under pressure, and you get liquid seeping out into lung tissue, and people will literally fill up with fluid, and doctors in the hospital will put needles in and pull that out and use other ways to treat it. But that is sort of a drowning feeling from your heart not working. Maybe more similar to his condition would be there's other types of lung disease that you can get where the tissue itself becomes a little bit more rigid. So a lot of people might be familiar with COPD or chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, a consequence of tobacco, cigarette smoking or tobacco use over time, where you have a hard time moving the air out. But there's this other type of lung disease where the lungs' ability to open up and inflate becomes more difficult. It's generally grouped, that's, we call it interstitial lung disease or pulmonary fibrosis, that you can get from exposure to chemicals and other things. And that becomes like trying to make your lungs start becoming like cement, so they're not moving well. So that might be a feeling that's similar to it. And it's a progressive thing that we can't treat very well. So it's, there's a, that inability for us to fix that one is very real.
All of this sounds wonderful, by the way.
Oh my God.
No.
This is all,
don't be sorry. We're literally asking you about this.
Right. No, it's totally fine. But like every time, and I'm sure it takes a certain type of person to do your job, to be a doctor, to get into medicine, because you have to, like, all of these things are terrible. You know, like the poor people who are going through and having to deal with these things, and you have to be the sound mind who's able to get to the heart of what the issue is and help them with the solution. Like, it just, props to what you do and what so many other medical workers do. But as a non-medical worker, I'm just like, oh my God, any of this sounds so terrible.
It does take a, there's that balance of, you know, being empathetic. I mean, I guess depending on how you interpret the word, really feeling what other people are feeling, empathy would really crush you because there's a lot of suffering. Yeah. So it kind of takes a little bit of a rational empathy of being able to understand and
relating
that pain without taking it on, you know, like a therapist, if they felt everything their patient was feeling would not last very long. So it does take a little bit of that. That's a definitely a balancing act for physicians to not also not feel and not be turned off the suffering of other people.
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Well, I was just going to go back to the hemoglobin.
Yes, please do.
I think it's fascinating that it's hemoglobin that they say that, because that's sort of a unique protein that has evolved from us being on the planet we're on, that is very iron rich. And not that you couldn't have another creature with hemoglobin. I could see some other iron-based protein or something, but maybe, you know, they call it that. It's like, oh, that's very unique.
The same exact term in a different species.
Yeah.
Perhaps it is possible with the Drell having been, you know, their home planet was Rakana. So it was an arid desert world. I can see a lot of metals being present in the surface.
Yeah. So an iron base, we'll call it hemoglobin. So yeah, if there is a problem of destruction or production of hemoglobin, then and we see this in people too. Anemia is the broad term for not having enough of a cell made protein. And we think of usually red blood cells. There can be a production problem, which might be what happens in Kepler syndrome. If it's a destruction problem, we have that too, where our bodies will attack or destroy our red blood cells. There's infectious diseases that affect our red blood cells, like malaria. Sickle cell, I don't think would be, I don't know that you lose, I don't know enough about sickle cell. I don't know that you lose a lot of oxygen carrying capacity. I think you just have these misshapen cells that hurt. But I can imagine that as you are losing your oxygen carrying capacity also, that puts another strain on the system. So the lungs are already not getting working well. You don't have now the red blood cells to bring, or the hemoglobin to carry the oxygen around. So your heart's working harder. Your lungs are trying to breathe faster, and you feel like you're drowning and short of air the whole time. And it would probably be a pretty miserable, I don't think he would quietly close his eyes and say his goodbyes like that happened. It would be probably pretty miserable, honestly.
Probably something a little bit too visceral to display in a video game, you know. Yeah.
Or doesn't close out the story with the tone that they wanted you to close the story out with, right? So they make those changes.
I mean, I do like, though, they did give him a bit of a, you know, he was sick pretty early on, and it kind of just kept getting worse and worse, if I recall. And they did, I like the way they did that, honestly. I don't think I would have wanted it to be that real.
You know? Yeah, that would have hurt a little bit too much for the players. But on the topic of diseases, the Fortinbras plague is probably the most detailed description of a disease that we get in Mass Effect, and yet a lot of players don't ever learn about it because it's part of the books. And more specifically, it's part of the books about Mass Effect Andromeda. So I'd like to recap the medical part of this, you know, explanation, and kind of just have you comment when something comes to mind. So first of all, the Fortinbras plague was artificially made, taking traits from a bunch of different infectious and deadly diseases impacting almost every Milky Way species. It mutates very easily. It can spread through the air and, you know, stay on surfaces. And it has an R naught of 22 to 26, which is about as contagious as the measles. So how contagious is this really?
Okay. Well, an R naught is how much, you know, how easily it is for one person to spread it to how many other people. But it's not necessarily just a biological number inherent in the organism. It is a created number that is about even relationships with other people and how it's spread and communities and how we interact. So it's a very specific to the disease itself and the community it's spread in that way. But that is really infectious. I mean, if an R naught of 2 is something that can easily become exponential on its own.
Right. Cause it's a doubling effect. 2 becomes 4, becomes 8, becomes 16. Right.
Yeah. And, you know, I don't know how the R naught is. I think it's, you know, a disease that kills you quickly tends not to have as high of an R naught. So something like Ebola, I don't know what its R naught is, but it's probably, for as deadly as it is, in the way it's spread also, it probably has a much lower R naught. But yeah, that's 20. That's high. That's crazy.
Yeah. So it's funny you should bring that up, that diseases and viruses that have, you know, a low R, or that are deadly, tend to have a lower R naught. Well, this one has a, you know, very high R naught, and it is incredibly deadly, killing people within 24 hours. But interesting coincidence about the measles, because the virus was made using traits from the measles, as well as something called Asari cyanophage. I'm not sure what that is, but I'm guessing, given the etymology of that word, it would mean something that maybe erases how blue the Asari are. Keppel syndrome, so they did take traits from that. A Turian disease called Titan's Tears, and the Volus equivalent of chickenpox called Yoctan.
Who was a chef, a bioterrorist chef that made all of this?
Right. And so I was going to ask you, you know, would it actually be possible or even like conceivable to create a virus from traits of other viruses, let alone this many other ones? Or does it, you know, are you aware of how difficult that would be? Or?
Oh, I mean, in theory, it's plausible, right? That you can construct a RNA sequence to do all these things. I mean, can we do that now? No, I don't think so. But that's not that crazy to imagine. We can do it with other types, like with DNA, pretty easily with CRISPR. What we can create is it's actually pretty impressive and frightening.
Yeah. For example, my wife does research on mice at the lab that she runs, and they have mouse models, is what they're called, where they have genetically changed mice specifically for their brains to use a certain protein that is only found in human brains, now actually works in a mouse. And that is not something that happens in nature. They had to genetically engineer that.
Yeah. So we're already there with DNA, right? Where the technology is where you can take the area you want and put in something new. Like we were there, instead of just breeding and trying to create a trait by selection. But I don't know that they can do that with RNA yet, but it's plausible, right? It's something that you could imagine being done. Now, how to create something that you know all the effects would be quite a challenge. I don't know that it'd be as easy as just stick all these different viruses together and then you get all the problems. It probably doesn't work that way unless it's a combo thing. I don't know. But
It didn't work that way for the person who concocted this virus either. It ended up being a lot more volatile than they wanted.
Tested on his neighbor and he got it himself.
More or less. So this was made by the captain of the Corian Ark, because the thought was, as soon as we get to the Andromeda galaxy, we want, if we can decimate the numbers of the council races, then we will not be treated as second tier citizens anymore. So it was supposed to be targeted toward them, but the virus, and it was supposed to spread on this arc where all of the races on that arc were not council races. So they were supposed to be carriers. And then by the time they get there, just spread it very quickly.
Brutal. The Quarians are actually really interesting in that regard with their immune system. That's another kind of realistic problem. And I like the way I think in my second playthrough, I got Tali to remove some of her protection. And the consequence was like she was down and out needing antibiotics for a period of time. I thought that was brilliant.
So if there was a, like, theoretically, if you took a bunch of humans and put them on a spaceship, which was completely sterile for like a long time, it really would impact immune systems that way?
Well, no, I'm more thinking of diseases where people have lost their immune system. And, you know, when I was a kid, there was that book about David, the boy in the bubble, who literally they didn't have anything but to keep him away from everyone, very much like the Quarian setup. I don't know about keeping us on a ship over such a long time that we would lose our immune system. We are such a mixture of organisms already. We're not these sterile, just human cells. You know, there's more bacteria in the first inch of your colon than there are people on Earth. So we're a lot more other than we are us, I guess. So I don't know how that would happen.
There's a poop joke here somewhere, but I haven't formulated it yet.
We're full of shit is what you're trying to say. Yeah, there you go. Sometimes it's the more simple ones.
Hey, chime in real quick, just to go back to the R-naught thing, I do have some details on here. Just to put this in perspective, the seasonal influenza is at a 0.9 to a 2.1. It varies between there. Ebola, 1.51 to 2.53. So slightly more infectious than the flu. So a 22 to 26 is an order of magnitude above that. Just
that
straight up.
And you know, I wasn't aware before Greg had brought this up that it was socially influenced. But that makes sense if they are on an enclosed spaceship where
with recycled air
quarters, recycled air, pretty tight quarters, 20,000 people on this arc. Maybe that had something to do with why that R-naught is so high.
Yeah, that would make sense. Exactly. That would be the type of scenario. It's like, well, this is the situation in which this is spreading. So it's R-naught and this situation is here. And it might be different when you look at it in other kind of arenas.
Right. So maybe it wouldn't have been as infectious, you know, when they get to the Andromeda galaxy and they are on the planet. People have space to spread out and live. But about Fortinbras plague, I wanted to go over the symptoms. So I'm going to list off the symptoms that we know about that occur at different stages. And maybe, you know, a way they could have treated these symptoms on the Ark. So it starts with if this sounds familiar to any listeners, it's because we just went over this last week. But it starts with copious projectile vomiting, coughing, fever, chills, and nausea.
Okay, so we're beyond prevention. We're just jumping into treatment. So on a ship, they probably need hoses.
for the projectile vomit.
Antiemetics if you haven't really started vomiting yet. Doesn't sound like any diarrhea, so you could give rectal suppositories, going back to the colon reference.
At least there's that.
Good old-fashioned antiemetics and maybe some antipyretics like Tylenol, ibuprofen to get your fevers down. That would probably be the easiest thing to deal with. And then rehydration. If you're feverish, you're vomiting, you're probably getting dehydrated pretty easily. So
I have a clinical question for you, Greg. How would you suppose that you could put a rectal suppository in a Hanar?
Oh, God.
I'm not sure I'd be able to find it in the first place. I'd probably ask for permission, for some consent there first.
I'm sure there's plenty of artwork on the internet that shows us hand our butts.
You have a little tail kind of back end thing, don't they?
That they do. Yeah. Maybe that's, I don't know. Maybe that's where that, you know, when we were planning this episode, I never thought about shoving things up Hanar asses, but here we are.
Oh man.
There's something kind of, just since we're talking about colons, there's something kind of unique about our colon's blood supply that is that, well, this is the part that maybe this is a college thing, but anyway, regardless, the blood that when we absorb from food, from our stomach, our intestines, it all goes into this separate circulatory system that goes through the liver to filter out toxins first. Mm-hmm. But the last part of the colon's blood supply doesn't connect to that. And it goes straight to our, I think, vena cava, essentially. It basically goes straight back into mainline treatment. So you can bypass the liver by using rectal medication.
That's why the suppositories work.
Yeah, it helps. It makes it a little bit more potent. I mean, I was going to say that's why the wine enemas or whatever that people would use would bypass their liver, get drunk quicker or whatever, whatnot.
Yeah. So let's move on, because these symptoms progress very quickly. The next symptom is that it turns their sweat into a sweet smell. And we debated this on the last episode. We're like, wait, is that pulling from a real world thing?
Yeah, I saw part of that. And there is, in diabetics, you do see ketoacidosis when someone's really sick with really high blood sugars. You do get, and I don't honestly recall what part of the ketone creates that smell, but it creates a smell that you can detect in their breath. It's, I think of it as like kind of a grape or artificial grape flavor smell.
All right.
I don't know, but so that's a real possibility. And, you know, if there's some excretion of sugars in some way that we would call sweet, like also in diabetics, the urine will be sweet, which is how it was, one of the ways it was diagnosed earlier before we had the ability to check for sugars. We'd take a little sip and.
Oh man.
I was just going to ask to the taste or the smell, but I kind of did want to know. I kind of didn't want to know, but I guess I'm better for it. So as Tom said, it progresses really quickly.
Yeah.
And a few hours in, people who are infected, they start developing these sores that then burst.
And they're blue.
And they're blue.
Blue sores.
Regardless of the species or the race.
I suppose so. Yeah. A lot of the symptoms are common among different races. And then the people get super violently hungry.
Like super munchies.
Okay. That could happen.
Ravenous. Okay. So ravenous hunger is a symptom of actual diseases.
God, is it?
Well, it sounds like at this point it's affecting the brain. It's gotten past the brain blood barrier, maybe, and I'm talking out of my butt here, another butt joke, but like if something makes you feel hungry, right, then probably it's affecting your nervous system to give you a symbol, like a signal that you need to eat even when you don't.
Yeah, well, there is that, like if our brain needs, you know, sugar as its fuel, and if we get low blood sugar, especially artificially, like back to a diabetic using too much insulin, blood sugar being pushed artificially down, the hunger drive kicks in really strong. People get really hungry, which is kind of a survival mechanism that, you know, so maybe some hijacking of those hormones or signals coming from the brain too about our hunger that could happen. Hmm. Do they eat other people? Do they get so hungry they start eating things they wouldn't eat?
Well, I don't want to spoil too much about the book.
Say violently hungry though.
Let's skip forward to the next symptom. So about 12 hours later, and patients are struggling to breathe from the edemas swelling on their throats and chests.
Oh gosh.
So how would that be treated?
Okay, so it depends on what sort of response that may be. Let's say it's people do can get swelling around their throat. Usually that is allergic or a reaction. So it could be something like epinephrine. Typical edema is fluid overload, what I was talking about with the heart and lungs earlier too. So maybe diuretics, and maybe just putting in an airway to help get them through it if they need a artificial airway deep down into the lungs.
I'm wondering about the combination of these symptoms and how horrendous it would be to have copious projectile vomiting along with an edema around your throat.
And also being hungry.
And they're the hungry ones are probably eating the vomit.
Oh, God. Oh, man. We should have put a warning at the beginning of this episode. If anybody's squeamish, this is not the episode to listen to.
Well, you know, we did go over diseases last week, so I think we've set the bar. But
it's true.
Yeah. Okay, so right before death, people start hallucinating and losing their mind and attacking other people at random. So fair to say that this is now affecting the brain?
Yeah, for sure. And it would probably be affecting for humans like a frontal lobe or the decision-making areas. And we have viruses that I saw a patient that had a viral herpes, actually encephalitis, and her brain was not working. She was saying things without just coming out with kind of graphic, inappropriate things that she would not normally say, just kind of spewing that. I don't remember behavior wise that it affected her behavior, but her speech was. The brain could totally be affected and kind of hijacked.
It is amazing. It is amazing how crucial
like
brains.
Those. What do you call those funguses that family of funguses that affects insects?
That turns them into little zombies, the little zombie.
Yeah. It changes their behavior. Not only does it erupt from their body, but it gets them to want to crawl up to a high place to spread it over the colony.
Where they're more likely to be eaten and then it spreads. Yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, that's a real cordyceps, I think is what they're called, but it's that family that, you know, we could imagine something getting into your brain ultimately and kind of hijacking it if it helps it spread, you know.
And this is kind of just a crazy, I mean, from a average person's point of view, this is a crazy combination of symptoms, and the fact that it's all happening within a day, and then within a day most people die except for the Elcor. They persevere for some time, but we went over the deaths of the Volus last episode.
Oh,
and so they are particularly gruesome because, as you know, that the Volus are within these pressurized suits because they're from a very highly pressurized planet. Mm-hmm. So when they're on the Ark, they need the suits. And because of the insane swelling and the edemas and the pressurized suits, you know, you got force expanding and something pressurizing, keeping it in, and they eventually explode.
That's what happens to a Volus?
That is what
they
happens to the Volus.
They turn into like jelly inside their suits.
I can't imagine that working, but I'll give them that.
So they would likely die before then, right?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, the swelling would be kept. I mean, I don't know. I have to imagine their biology. I don't know what would happen for the Volus. I don't know that they would explode, though.
I mean, wouldn't I'm just imagining here. Wouldn't you imagine that the blood pressure would rise to a point where eventually they would just have cardiac arrest before the rest of their body pops? I mean, that's the primary fluid in our bodies is blood.
Right. And I think in some ways, swelling wouldn't happen because they're in pressurized suits. So it's the rest of us that aren't that are going to have the swelling. They wouldn't be.
We're more likely to pop.
Yeah.
Well,
so yeah, exactly, though, Tom. I think you're right. It would be. They would die from something else before they explode.
Well, that brings me a little bit of solace for the Volus. But so last question before we hit the mid break, do these present in any close combination to any real life disease, or is it pretty fiction?
I mean, the whole constellation is kind of out there, but there are things that can spread and progress pretty quickly and become horrific. There is types of bacteria that we call it necrotizing fasciitis. And it is one of these, it produces a gas too, as it you know, you might've seen people get infection and over a day or so, it kind of becomes a larger infection or an abscess. Well, this is, you can get this from scratching your leg on a metal desk. And if they shoot up in the ER, you know, if you go to refill your coffee, it'll look different when you come back. I mean, it's happening pretty quickly.
Wow.
And I don't know if this is appropriate, but my number one do not want disease is Fournier's gangrene, which is this necrotizing fasciitis in a very unfortunate location. So don't Google that. And so that's pretty horrific, and it's a skin infection. It happens very quickly. I think Ebola itself, the hemorrhagic Ebola, is really pretty gnarly. You know, it kind of liquefies your organs. You ultimately just start hemorrhaging from all over. So it's
yeah.
Maybe that's what the so
the combination of everything. Oh, but the horrificness of it. And then I talked about the encephalitis from herpes, or and that was there's probably a lot worse.
So can happen. So this Fortinbras plague is basically attacking like all systems of the body.
It sounds like it. I don't. Yeah. So this is not in the game. It's in the expansion books.
Right. Okay. It is part of Mass Effect Andromeda Annihilation, that book. Okay. So.
So we're already almost 50 minutes into the show for a mid-break, because this is how stimulating these conversations go. This happens. So we're going to take a really quick mid-break. I know that we don't want to keep you too long, but when we get back, Sam, why don't you pick out some last questions, some highlights and things that we can cover, and then we'll get to the rest of the show. So So don't go anywhere. We'll be right back.
Prescription products require completion of an online medication consultation with an independent healthcare provider through the LifeMD platform and are only available if prescribed. Subscription required. Individual results may vary. Additional restrictions apply at LifeMD.com. Read all warnings before using GLP-1s. Side effects may include a risk of thyroid C-cell tumors. Do not use GLP-1s if you or your family have a history of thyroid cancer.
If you've struggled for years to lose weight and have given up hope, did you know you can now access GLP-1 prescription medications through LifeMD? LifeMD is now offering eligible patients online access to GLP-1s, the breakthrough prescription medication that can help you lose body fat and weight. Listen to what people are saying.
You just take your shot. It doesn't feel like you're on a diet. What I wasn't expecting it to do was to shut off the food noise. This was life-altering, and if I can do it, I feel like anybody can do it.
And here's the best part. Your insurance may cover 100% of the cost of your medication. So go to TryLifeMD.com to have your eligibility checked right now. Get started today at TryLifeMD.com. That's TryLifeMD.com.
Patching it through.
I am sovereign, and this station is mine. I like the sound of that.
So we're recording this very close to the last episode. We don't have any new patrons or new reviews to read out. So we're going to do this real quick. Thank you to all the patrons and everybody who helps to support the show. And shout outs to all of our shepherds, Kolka Shins, Kira C, Lieutenant Tosino, Shep Valkyrian, that's Spectre J, and William, and all 70 of our current patrons. Thank you so much for your support. We really do appreciate it. Patreon.com/MassEffectLorecast if you want to get ad-free episodes, t-shirts, join us on future episodes of the show, any of that stuff. Go check that out. And thank you to everybody who leaves five-star ratings and reviews and shares with your friends and all of that stuff. But we're going to get back to the real stuff and continue to gross you out. So here we go.
Spit it out, or are you trying to build suspense?
You're so dense, sir. Obviously, I do not know as much about human relationships as I thought.
All right, we're back. And I know we've got you at least for the hour. Are you okay if we go over a little bit?
Yep.
Dr. Greg's all right. All right. So, Sam, where do we want to go now? We've been talking about the practice of medicine, but in Mass Effect and that kind of stuff. Where are we going next?
So... yeah, we've been into the really hard medicine topics, but I'd like to talk more about the people. As Greg had mentioned earlier, that you know Greg's background is far more relationship focused. So we did a character deep dive of Dr. Chakwas. Since she's more or less the only consistent spotlighted human doctor we have in the original trilogy, how do you think BioWare did in its portrayal of medical professionals?
Oh, well, I love Dr. Chakwas probably because she is the ship doctor and is just great voice acting and her personality. It's not really my day to day. Like you don't see her, she's in her clinic, but it's almost like you get to hang out with her there. I think you pull out and have drinks with her, or you can, it's one option, I think.
Yeah, that's right.
So it didn't quite look like she was, it looked like she was always kind of on break, I guess. But I don't know what it's like as a military provider on a ship. Maybe there is some informality too. And but I really liked her as a character. I just didn't see a lot of my day to day and what she did. She seemed to have every bit of equipment that you needed. And I think, was there another doc? And
there was Dr. Michelle. That was the other human doctor you could bring on.
Okay. I seem to remember, and I might be making this up, that you could go in and I think you had to give her credits to get medical supplies or to get something. I feel like I had to pay her. And I remember thinking like, oh yeah, okay, sure. That was pretty real. Go over some credits.
Welcome to America.
Yeah.
But I might be misremembering that.
Capitalist expansion for Mass Effect. Okay. So, well, shifting gears, we know that you have a special love for Dr. Solis, as in Morden Solis. I'd just like to ask why.
Oh my goodness. I appreciate the way that he thinks so analytically. That is not how, you know, how the rest of us are, but he that portrayal for a very fleshed out character is really beautiful. And then he has these things too, where he's singing and brings in color. And honestly, his end arc was like, I think when I like cried in the game, probably for the first time, or it was so beautiful seeing his kind of pivot. And I think going back and playing it and hearing his attitudes at the beginning was a little wrenching, and realizing, oh yeah, he really kind of comes around on how he feels about the genophage.
Yeah, that conversation, if you play a certain way, you can get conversation with him where he basically, Shepard corners him and doesn't really allow him to save face about his prior mistakes with the genophage. And Morden can kind of snap and yell at Shepard, you know, I made a mistake. And it's like, man, that one cuts you deep. But we have this clip here. I promised you that we would play some clips from Morden's personality.
Okay.
And very apparent here, I think.
Shepard, how can I help?
Have you got a minute to talk?
Perhaps later. Trying to determine how scale itch got onto Normandy. Sexually transmitted disease only carried by Varen. Implications unpleasant.
Have you got a minute to talk?
Some other time. About to test new bioweapon. Not on us, of course. Didn't think I had to specify, but Joker got nervous.
Have you got a minute to talk?
Not a good time. Trying to map contamination vectors requires focus. Shipwide infection of human-tailored virus possible if I slip.
Have you got a minute to talk?
Later, better. Think I've cured Joker's condition. Simple treatment would... No. Would cause liver failure. Never mind. Start from scratch.
Love it.
So, yeah, like you said, he's so analytical. You know, do his mannerisms and very literal treatment of conversation... Like, have you seen that in the medical world at all?
Oh, yeah. We all know people like that. And there's certainly a degree that... You know, folks that think that way could be attracted to medicine, among other fields, for sure.
That's, I think, the stereotype. And in that way, do you think that BioWare was making a parody of the highly cerebral physicians?
Oh, I guess so. I didn't feel insulted or like they were poking fun at us. But yeah, that makes sense. I could see that. Yeah, because he is more of kind of like the research scientist more than. I guess he's still the physician too, or a physician, but he like is more roles. Like a researcher.
Yeah.
And he was also a spy.
Yeah.
So he wore a lot of hats. And so we have some more clips of Morden's medical advice. So he gives the players medical advice depending on who you romance in Mass Effect 2. So it can be different. And I'd like to get your opinion on Morden's medical advice and whether or not maybe it's sound.
Shepard, how can I help?
Have you got a minute to talk?
Actually, wanted to talk. Medical matters. Aware that mission is dangerous. Different species react differently to stress. aware that you and Jack are sexually active, or planning to be, suggest caution. Emotionally unstable biotics dangerous during intercourse.
I'm aware that Jack is dangerous, but I want to see where this goes.
Of course, hormones. We'll be here to set broken bones later.
You have a recommendation as a doctor?
Can give biotic inhibitor to dampen neural receptors, weaken unintentional biotic effects. No guarantees. Suggest padding walls. Biotic ability also gives benefits. Forwarding booklet to your quarters. Includes diagrams, exercises, inventive uses of mass effect fields. Can supply oils or ointments to reduce discomfort. Gave ED electronic relationship aid demonstration vids to use as necessary. Past relationship with Talizora makes dalliance attractive as stress release.
Oh, I guess we should... Yeah. We should do the first one. Let's talk about the first one before moving on to the second one.
Yeah, let's talk about Morden's advice to Shepard while romancing Jack.
I think he refers to sedation there at some point, which is awful. He does give a lot of options and has a lot of different feedback for how he can help Commander Shepard in a sexual experience, which is hilarious.
Yes.
I'm not going to comment on that.
I feel like he's the kind of person who's like, why would that be a boundary? It's you clearly have a problem and I have a solution, right?
Yeah, he's problem solving for sure, right?
Yeah.
You can do it this way. You can do it this way. You can drug her. You can pad the rooms. You can practice with this AI here. Right.
Maybe the drug was for Shepard. maybe it was, you know, just to numb the pain.
It could be generous.
Yeah. So I know the next one talks about Tally, and you made a comment about how you have a special affinity for the Quarians, and how their suits and how Tally develops the infection. I think Morden has some medical advice about that.
Oh, great.
Past relationship with Talizora makes dalliance attractive as stress release. Still, recommend caution. Quarian immune system weak could kill her.
Tally is important to me. I wouldn't be doing this if she didn't want it to.
Of course, no offense intended. We'll be here to provide treatment as necessary. Minimize risk.
You have a recommendation as a doctor?
Talizora acquired antiseptic. Recommend you self-sterilize as well. Oral contact with tissue dangerous. Take precautions. Also forwarding advice booklet to your quarters. Valuable diagrams, positions comfortable for both species, erogenous zone overviews. Sexual activity.
I love that. Totally matter of fact. How can I help you here? No boundaries.
Mm-hmm.
Take the extra step to, if you are going to bring on this risk, then here's the other things you can do.
To my ears, as a non-medical professional, it all sounds like good advice too. Do you?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So
yeah, I would agree. Yeah. It sounds great.
Yeah. Okay.
Right, I mean, cool. If I was being very matter of fact with my doctor about my relationship with an alien, then I guess that's the response that I'd want.
Yeah, I love the tips at the end that he's like, okay, we're going to do this. This is what we need to do. Oh, and by the way, this might also help in this as well, and not related to the infection. But yeah, it's great.
So
he recommends self-sterilizing and avoiding oral contact.
yeah. So moving on from these, we have kind of softer questions here, but who knows where this goes. Let's talk about the regeneration of scars. Because we get this answer from Dr. Chakwas about the regeneration of your scars and how having a positive attitude and focusing on healing, then the scars heal faster, right? That's going the Paragon route. Is there any truth to that? I mean, obviously mindset can affect a lot of things, but when it comes to something like healing scars?
Oh, interesting. Well, I didn't know that if you became a Paragon, your scars would heal.
Yes, and if you go Renegade, they get worse.
Yeah, it affects the way you look. You look nicer or you look meaner.
Well, you know, from allopathic medicine, we don't know everything. We only know what there's evidence for. That's kind of the strength of allopathic medicine, evidence-based medicine. And I seem to remember this is older study. I remember hearing about it in residency, and it was actually more about prayer. And what it was is they were trying to see if prayer helped. And I forget the numbers in the groups, but basically those people who knew they were being prayed for did better to some degree. Those who were prayed for that didn't know about it didn't do any better than the controls. And it was that element of, and maybe, so this is maybe kind of similar to the positive thinking, that knowing that you're being, people are thinking about you or thinking positively about that. Right. So it's not quite the same.
Expecting results in a way, like the positive expectation of something working lends towards it working. It's the same reason why if I take aspirin to relieve pain, or if you as a doctor hand me the aspirin, the effects of you handing me the aspirin will make it more effective.
Placebo, if I didn't tell you, said I can't tell you what this is, but I promise you there's almost no side effects and you're going to feel better, and I'm giving you a Skittle, that works. It's effect is crazy.
I've seen studies on placebo that they expanded out from like taking to, you know, even if you take a sugar pill in a hospital by a doctor in a doctor's like outfit, full fleshed on outfit, that has more of an effect in some cases than taking certain types of medication at home just over the counter. There's obviously a lot of nuance to this in the details, but placebo is verifiably a real thing, like you're saying. And so maybe this ties into that a little bit, but like the fixing of scars on your face.
Maybe a bit of a stretch, but I think the concept is probably rooted in truth. I can't tell you more evidence right off, but I'd go with that. Commander Shepard's got some pretty spicy immune system that's, you know, an overachiever and it's feeling good.
Apparently impenetrable. And, you know, talking about Commander Shepard, the Lazarus Project. Shepard is brought back to life after falling from orbit into a planet. And I guess, you know, like, I don't know how much of the body was left. They say it was really only scraps, but let's watch that scene.
Okay.
And I'd like to get your thoughts right after it.
Commander Shepard has been recovered. The Lazarus Project will proceed as planned.
So did you catch all of that? Was there more, Sam, or was that it?
There was more, but I believe it's just Miranda, you know, waking Shepard up, and you can hear Wilson in the background saying heart rate's increasing, and, you know.
Right.
So then they try to bring down Shepard's heart rate. But from what we heard and what we saw in that rebuilding of Shepard scene, did anything stand out to you?
Yeah. And so we'll just say, putting his mind and memory aside, let's just say we're talking about the body here. We have the ability to grow tissues, but it would be a really a big challenge to build piecemeal an adult, like you're assembling a machine. I could see very easily the idea of having a cell and being able to pull his DNA and clone, essentially grow a clone, as, you know, the organs, you know, the cells migrate into the different systems and the nerves branch out and reach, and growing it that way, the way we all grow. But piecemealing together a body into adulthood and having nerves connect, it's a little bit more of a stretch, but, you know, that is not the hard leap, I think. I think the hard leap is his mind, and that, you know, a clone would be like more like a twin in a way. And to have Commander Shepard's memories would be, you know, in theory, if you could freeze this brain state he had, let's say, then, you know, the where all the nerves are, how they're connected, and even the energy state of the electrons of all the atoms there, and then could replicate that somehow. In theory, you could sort of have a hard drive of his brain saved, but that's, you know, that's a bigger stretch. And I just, okay, I'll accept that. I'll let that go. I would have liked it if he had some messed up memories or some challenges kind of coming. I don't remember him really struggling too hard with remembering who he was or his parents. And yeah, I don't remember that.
Right. And so that, yeah, I was going to say, you know, the mentality and the mind and memory aspect, I as just a regular player with no experience in medicine or health at all, that was the most unbelievable part to me.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And I do think, I don't remember the graphics from that, because I thought, oh yeah, they brought him back. I thought it was sort of from a fetal cell type of growth, or, you know, a rapid growth process. I didn't realize they were building little pieces and sticking it together, which seems the hard way to do it.
or revitalizing organs that look like they're dead and bringing them back to life. I mean, there's some of that symbolism in there too, it looks
like. Yeah, a little bit of that, like Lazarus, you know, breathing life into this dead tissue that somehow is
enough parts. Yeah.
Right, they just inject it with mystery liquid and things and
space magic.
Technology and space magic. Yeah. But maybe they went that route as a narrative way just because they didn't want to address the whole am I really Shepard thing. Mm-hmm. Because they do, of course, I don't know if you've played the Citadel DLC, Greg, but clone Shepard exists. So,
oh, right. That's
so
right.
They have a clone Shepard. That was probably the easier way to do it scientifically, you're saying, but that Shepard took the back burner and existed for spare organs.
And was he was part of the Cerebrus project then? He was part of Project Lazarus, is that right?
Yes, that Shepard was part of the project, but we never got to see it until that point.
Yeah. Okay, yeah. Right.
You also wouldn't expect that clone to have the same memories of the original brain if it was cloned from nothing, right? That doesn't make any sense. Unless they have a way of like saving brain states to some sort of like hard drive and then uploading it into another organic brain in a way
but
that
you'd think
would
that,
work, but
that you would need like the entire gray matter, right, to do that.
Something, yeah.
Maybe, I don't know. Yeah.
The brain is a very complex organism.
Yeah. There is something I think you said, Tom, about the idea of seeing parts of his old body being pieced back together, that is that we identify with, oh, that's still him, in the same way we, yeah, you know, we look at our own body as, oh, this is me, even though it's constantly changing. There's other organisms, you know, we're not, it's a little bit of an illusion.
Right. Theseus's ship.
But this helps create
Theseus?
That.
The ship of Theseus? Yeah. Yeah. The idea of, you replace a number of planks on a boat. At what point is it no longer the original boat? Right. Yeah. But like the human body is doing that all the time. We're constantly regenerating cells and growing and changing. But yet still have this sense of self that we're still the same thing we always were. Even though piece by piece, we're not.
Yeah. And it could have also been the elusive man's purest attitude, you know, because this was a project that the elusive man directly was involved with. And the elusive man is so extreme in the human purest attitude, which is weird because he doesn't seem to be against using cybernetics to enhance humanity. Yeah. But I guess it makes sense if you want to keep Shepard, Shepard, right? So,
right, that makes a lot of sense.
Well, thank you. Oh, sorry, I was gonna wrap this up. Did you have anything else you wanted?
Go ahead.
I was gonna say, well, thank you for joining us. This has been an awesome conversation and a lot of really cool insights from somebody who has an expertise very different from me or Sam. Is there any other? Is there any other final thoughts on any of this before we wrap it up?
Ooh, if you guys have more specific things down the road and want to hit me up, I'm happy to be a part of it.
Oh, I'm sure we can come up with more. Like, this feels like one of those conversations that like could go on for another hour if we really had the time. So, but yeah, thank you so much for joining us. Is there anything you want to share about ways people can reach out or other stuff going on?
Oh, I don't really do. I mean, the only thing I have on Twitch is a Star Wars RPG that is probably maybe not up everyone's alley, but that's all I've got going on.
Cool. Cool.
You're sick. Go see your doctor, do your preventative visits.
Get vaccinated.
Yeah. Get vaccinated. Exactly.
Do all the doctor things that the doctors tell you to do because they know better than we all do. So yeah. Yeah. Dr. Greg, thank you so much for joining us. This has been awesome.
My pleasure.
And thank you, Greg.
Yeah. Sam, anything going on that you want to share before we wrap it up?
Well, I'm streaming, as everyone knows, you know, most Thursdays I'll stream Andromeda, not today, of course. But I will be streaming Mass Effect, my neutral Shepard playthrough, who doesn't really feel any particular way about anything that's going on. And he really just wants to go home. That's on Saturday. Every Saturday, you can find me on Twitch and Twitter at N7TheLegend. And for those who are listening to the show, and also listening and watching my streams, bear with me as I try to get the hang of this mixer. I've also ordered a Stream Deck. So I got the mini one. I'm looking forward to the production quality increase.
That's awesome. That's awesome. Have fun with your toys. All of my shows are over at robotsradio.net, and you can check out any of the other lore casts that I do, Lord of the Rings or The Witcher or The Elder Scrolls or Fallout, and then also Starfield, which is getting closer and closer to an event because they mentioned that there's going to be an event for Starfield and the launch date will probably be given sometime in the next month or two, I would hope. So awesome stuff for that. So stay tuned for that stuff as well. But thanks again, Dr. Greg, and chat and everybody else for being here. You guys are awesome. We will see you next time. Until then, stay safe out there and, you know, do what your doctor says. See you guys later.
Thanks for tuning in to the Mass Effect Lorecast. We'd love to hear your opinion and thoughts on the lore of Mass Effect. Reach out to us on Twitter at Mass Effect Cast or check out the Robots Radio Discord. Also, you can send us an email at masseffectlorecast@gmail.com.